Hi, can people hear me okay? Is the volume all right? Everything is good. Thank you. Great. So thanks for the invitation to come and talk to you again. I did it several months ago one time. Had a wonderful time, and it's great to be here and to see so many people, most of whom I have sat with and know, but great to see everybody and welcome. As a lot of you know, I'm not going to talk about the Musa Soseki poem again tonight, but like for a lot of us, it's still on my mind in one way or another. And the talk that I want to give, which is actually it's a version of something that I gave at a retreat a couple years ago, feels to me like it's in some way a response to some of the issues that get raised in the poem. And in particular, one of the talks that Megan gave was quite wonderful. In the discussion period afterwards, somebody said that there's a line, so before anyone remembers, it has been clear, though the moonlight penetrates it and the wind or breeze, I forget which, ruffles it, no trace of either remains. And so we were all drawn to that sense of no trace or tracelessness. And one person said in the discussion period that she felt particularly drawn to it because it would, the traces are so difficult. How many things sort of trace their way through us and retrace their way through us, and we're caught in our own karma and our own beliefs and so on. And Megan said something that I thought was really striking, which is that she didn't think that one precluded the other. I'm saying it in my own words, but that she didn't think that we needed to get rid of all those traces tracing their way through us and the residual effects of things that have happened to us, and kind of turn it into a blank slate in order to experience that sense of no trace. And so that got me to wondering, how the sense of no trace and the traces that we feel reweaving their ways through us maybe impinge on and affect and have a conversation with one another, and how to think about kind of what's that feeling of no trace that for all of us probably better be able to get along in some way with that sense of delusion and trace and models that we make to try to deal with things that won't go away. That, I was just thinking right now, there's a line in a little essay by the poet Frank O'Hara where he says, pain always produces logic, which is very bad for you. So that sense that we're endlessly kind of telling stories to deal with stuff. All right, so the talk, it should be about half an hour. I apologize, it's probably a little long, but it's also somewhat abstract. I'm not going to be going into a lot about how to deal with particular problems that trace their way through you, but so here we go. It would be nice to sort everything into two neat piles. Delusions over here and truths over there. Opinions over here, facts over there, or false opinions versus true opinions, or wrong names versus right names. Think fallen language versus the Adamic language we're told was spoken in Eden, or the mythic magical origin of the Chinese characters. Or to separate true predicates and judgments from false ones, or there's Plato's true philosophers versus those devious sophists who are always trying to trick you with their false ideas. A lot of Buddhism, including Zen, tends to take a more sweeping view, at least as a starting point. Why not take all your beliefs and judgments, all your models and names and opinions and supposed statements of fact, and put them at least for a while in just one big pile? The two-pile drill, though it's pretty much hardwired in, language is binary after all, yes or no, right or wrong, tends for all the benefit that provides to cause some serious problems. So if we put everything in one pile, right? It would be great if we could get to one pile by just tossing out the bad pile overboard, or tossing the bad pile overboard, leaving us with perfected and purified objects of knowledge. That's one view sometimes promulgated of what happens in Zen. But that's really just more of the two-pile drill, no? So on the whole, Zen takes to take a dim view of that approach, seeing it as a kind of subject-object world on steroids. Super knower and super known. So you're finally the perfected knowing subject who damn well knows the actual bleepin' object and keeps it with such perfect knowledge perfectly in place. So I'm saying that's a vision of Zen that we may have sometimes, but it's probably not the deal, right? It's like doing a jujitsu flip on Kant. Noumena, ahoy, so long, all merely crummy, human distorted, perceived phenomena, you know, seeing the things themselves as they really are. At the end of Hemingway's The Sun Also Rises, which I keep coming back to lately, the main male character's not always quite paramour, Brett, says regretfully, "We could have had such a damn good time, you know, if only we could get our objects right and our knowledge right." Jake replies with rueful humor, "Isn't it lovely to think so?" Okay, if not that, then what? All this sounds pretty abstract in a way, a problem in epistemology, the branch of philosophy that worries over the status of our knowledge. But the question of how to work with opinion and judgment has more than a casual relation to Buddhism's interest in the self, which may or may not exist, or may not exist and not exist. So with apologies, here's a quick day job sidebar. There's a little tiny critical theory thing. The Romanian linguist, critical literary critic, and psychoanalyst Julia Kristeva writes about an early stage of childhood language development called the thetic phase. Think of thesis and argument, or here the beginnings of the ability to make a rudimentary one. That snake is dangerous, say. That's a step up from mere designation, learning how to just say snake, because it adds a predication or judgment. And it turns out that acquiring that ability is a, or maybe the crucial step in generating what we mean by a human self, or what we can recognize as a human self or an I. A knower who stands over against the known thing and knows in their judgment how to position themselves over against it with a stance or attitude. What comes next is indeed the ability to use correctly the shifter pronoun I, which turns out to be trickier than you might think. So we learn to, you know, set ourselves over against the world and make those judgments. And then pretty soon after that, we learn to use the word I correctly. So I'll just tell a really quick story on my oldest daughter when she was about two. I was holding her up in my arms and there was a book way up high in the bookcase that she wanted. And she kept pointing at it and saying, "You want it, you want it." You know, because she didn't have the shifter correct yet. Anyway, they go together like a horse and carriage, judgments and a self. In our neck of the Zen woods anyway, we tend not to try to eradicate the self or stamp out its functions or stamp our little feet about them so much as to watch our sense of self come and go, get diffuse and reform. In know there's only going and coming, abiding nowhere, let the heart mind come forth. Maybe working with judgments and opinions with a similar attitude, watching them come and go, is one good way to work on, or is it with the self? Okay, Cohen time. I'll take a slightly winding path to get to the Cohen Kelly distributed on email. So for starters, here's a little story that Yuan Wu tells in his commentary to case 20 of the Blue Cliff Record, which is the case Long Yao's meaning of coming to the West, though it doesn't turn up here. So here's this little kind of sidebar story that Yuan Wu tells. Haven't you heard? Wu She went to see Shito. He had made an agreement with himself beforehand saying, if there's a chord at the first word, I'll stay. Otherwise, I'll go. Shito just sat on his seat. Shito shook out his sleeves and went out, which is apparently a Chan sign of contempt. You know, you flap your sleeves and you leave because there's no teaching here. Shito knew that Wu She was the vessel of truth, so he had extended his teaching to him by just sitting there. But She hadn't understood his meaning. He had announced his departure and gone out. When he got to the gate at the other end of the courtyard, Shito called to him, "Reverend." When She turned back, Shito said, "From birth to death, it's only this. Don't seek anymore for anything else by turning your head and revolving your brain." At these words, She was greatly enlightened. It's only this. In a way, that sounds like the 3 pounds of flax koan or hemp, but plain rice will also do just fine if you don't have a picture of flax or hemp. It ain't somewhere else, Jack. It's right under your nose. Just look right here, or it's as clear as the nose on your face. You know, it's only this. But I think there's more. Maybe it's because Wu She has walked off and Shito calls to him from across a distance. From birth to death, it's only this. Linguists call this a deictic, a pointing word. What happens here is a little stranger than pointing your finger at the bag of rice. Quite possibly, Shito doesn't even literally point. So it's a conundrum. This is what's right here, the rice in your nose, but it's also the surround, the background. And in a Zen context, that background can feel very big indeed, yet it's also somehow inside the foreground or no different from it. So maybe Shitto is pointing at something you can't point to, something that isn't a thing. What is this? Shui Feng asked in Blue Cliff Record 51. From birth to death, it's only this. It might fill you with awe or wonder, make you shiver at the ineffable, what you can't conjure up as something you could possibly objectify and know. Meanwhile, particulars are always rising and falling. As it says somewhere in the vast commentary on Zhaozhou's No, in No there's no going and coming, in No there's only going and coming. But we've forgotten delusions here, though they probably haven't forgotten us. So here's the email koan, which foregrounds a hypothetical seeker not so happy about the tenacity of traces, karmic consciousness, he calls them. What we think, what we live, and what lives us, because of how all those causes and conditions have made us the particular gnarly, twisty things we are, aren't they an insurmountable obstacle that will preclude true Zen seeing? So here's the koan. Guishan asked Yangshan, two teachers, right? The Guiyang school. Guishan asked Yangshan, suppose someone asks you out of the blue, sentient beings only have endless karmic consciousness with no foundation to rely on. How would you work with this? Yangshan says he'd pull a Shitto and Wuxie on him. So I'm comparing it to the last koan that we just looked at. If a student like that came, I'd say, hey, so-and-so. When the student turns his head, I'd say, what is it? I imagine the hypothetical student having a Wuxie moment here as it is pointed to and not pointed to. Then Yangshan says something I find really startling. So just to backtrack a little, if a student like that came, I'd call, hey, so-and-so, when the student turns his head, I'd say, what is it? Then I'd wait while he thinks about it. Then I'd say, not only is karmic consciousness endless, but there's no foundation to rely on. So he drops right back into that moment, what the hypothetical student has had as a concern. So Yangshan first takes a beat, allows a moment for the ineffable to manifest itself. And right into that space, that moment of awed disorientation and perhaps surprised and surprising reorientation, he drops karmic consciousness and calls it endless. Something shifts here, turns around. Dropped into this space, your delusions, opinions, and judgments are just more things in the foreground, rising and falling out of and back into that unspecifiable but palpable big this. They don't need to be any more of a problem or impediment than a tree or your friend. A cat, a cloud, a delusion, the sky, it doesn't matter. Your views don't need to be permanently eradicated or corrected and perfected into true judgments that would yield you an undistorted conceptual map of the things you think of as objects. I think we mostly regard our judgments as if they were good, expensive binoculars that magnified and clarified the object world, keeping things in proper focus and yielding us the truth. If we're grouchy or having a bad day, or if we're Zen students and have got the incurable itch, maybe we start to complain about our judgments as cut-rate distorting binoculars we ought to be able to replace with more expensive ones. But in this moment, something turns around and we see them in their own right. We see through them in a different sense. Instead of doggedly seeing the world through them, our particular pair of prescription lenses, we also just see them or see through them, like, I see right through you, you scoundrel, as empty, or is emptiness assuming another temporary form? This is a bigger deal than it might seem. What's more intimate for each of us than our feelings and judgments and thoughts? What more local and intimate experience of emptiness than to see them this way? Here's a story I sometimes tell on myself as example. At a weekend retreat in Tucson a long time ago with John Tarrant, I sat with my hands in prayer position for morning greeting, waiting for John to pass my cushion and look into my face, and presumably my soul. I guess it's worth noting that someone who knows me pretty well had been telling me that I'm defensive, though nothing can be further from the truth, of course. She was just attacking me. As John passed, I felt a kind of inward wince. He could tell I was doing it wrong. My heart mind wasn't right. I don't think I'm the only one who can sometimes find John a little bit scary. But right then it came over me that I had no idea at all what John was actually thinking. Duh. Instead of seeing John through my view of him, I was suddenly seeing through that view instead, as empty, dreamlike, insubstantial, rising and falling, going poof. I still find a couple things surprising about what happened next. First, such a small thing had disproportionate effects. It felt like everything fell open, starting with me, and things went on feeling that way for hours. The main thing, I think, was just the view going poof, going empty. Everything, including myself, felt lighter, brighter, more free. And it wasn't that a better, more correct view of what John was up to popped into my head to replace the poofed view. I didn't have a view of what he'd been thinking, and I didn't want one. I wanted to enjoy the lightness of not having that particular view right now, and of not having a view, though I didn't stop to bother to explain that way to myself at the time. It's true that in the disorientation of what was happening, the things around me seemed more vibrant, somehow more there and more dreamlike at once. But I didn't feel like I knew them better exactly. It felt more like they knew me. It was as if when the view that kept things stable went poof, I tumbled into the field instead of standing over against it as a knower knowing the known. If things were somehow more available to me, that felt like a function of my being more available to them. You might say that as the judgment fell away, the self of the thetic phase, I am I because I stand by my judgments, lost much of its separate solidity. One more aspect, which I'll import from some other related experiences reported by other people as well as my own. If sometimes one particular thing looms up out of the interpermeating field with particular intensity and sharpness, with what's sometimes called suchness or tathagata, it's oddly different from a knowable object set over against you. It's not like the subject-object relation perfected on steroids. Me over here behind the world's best binoculars, really once and for all, knowing the bleepin' object. If, say, a crow caws and that caw looms right up, it isn't exactly over against you. When it calls you, it fetches you. It's itself, it's everything suddenly concretized and local, and it's also dramatically you, you're fetched, and you answer the caw, you caw. It calls you into the field, and it calls you or recalls you to yourself, except self is the wrong word here, but all the alternatives I can think of feel clunky. If this whole description seems a little clunky too, that's doubtless in part a function of my clunkiness. But it's also true that the tradition says you have to know such moments for yourself, that conceptual language can point at them, but not quite render them. Of course, they are moments where the familiar knowing self set over against the known object relationship that's built into our language no longer quite obtains. So the tradition slips into oxymorons about a perfected knowledge that isn't knowledge, but a shifted feeling for or sense of things, or prajna, or Suzuki talks about something you can't experience but nevertheless do sort of experience, or that you don't experience but realize, maybe not mostly in the sense of becoming aware of it, but also of fulfilling it in your own person, realizing it, right? Though person also isn't the right word. And if you can't claim this as exactly an experience, maybe that's because it's less about laying claim or staking a claim to reality than being claimed by it. In such moments, the world lays claim to you without recourse, which can feel a little bit scary, but also surprisingly serene. As John says, you can rely on the fact that there's nothing to rely on. Andy says you really can rely on it. a groundless ground. Pretty nice. But maybe it's another Hemingway moment. If only we'd stayed there forever, we could have had such a damn good time. Isn't it lovely to think so? On the other hand, it's not necessarily a one-shot deal. It tends to recur in big and little versions. And karmic consciousness isn't an impediment to moments like this, but a gate. So luckily, delusions will recur, being endless, giving you lots of occasions for your known world to crack open and for you to fall in. But how about no trace and traces as an ongoing deal? When we're traced and tracing, deluded and self-deluding, where's no trace? A road sign, detour. I think it might be helpful to take a few minutes mapping some of what I've been adducing onto the Lankavatara Sutra, a difficult and complexly dialectical work about which I'm by no means an expert. I'll be relying on Red Pine's translation and commentary, as well as on talks by Joan Sutherland and Norman Fisher, and some of the sound files from Sarah's SMS study group of the Lanka, with the usual all errors are my own disclaimer. Supposedly, when the first Chan patriarch Bodhidharma, who brought intensive meditation-centered Buddhism to China, got up from his mythical many years facing a wall in a cave to pass the robe and bowl along to Weka, he gave him the Lankavatara Sutra with a "this is all you'll need" seal of approval. So it's a central Zen text. I need to note at the beginning that the Lanka is a paradox of the Cretan liar variety. A guy from Crete says all Cretans are liars. You guys know that one, right? You can't, there's no way to make sense of that. A guy from Crete says all Cretans are liars. So the Lanka is telling you in complexly propositional language about the radical distortions inseparable from propositional language. So in some way, the Lanka positions itself as the useful fiction, hoping to get at something beyond its words, ineffable. Starting, I think, from an appreciation of the fact that human selves are fundamentally structured by language, the subject-object relation language establishes, and the judgments and propositions speaking selves propound, the Lanka takes a sweeping view. So I hope that you feel that this, you know, corresponds in some way with what I've been talking about. So the Lanka takes a sweeping view and says that every view or model or judgment we put forth is projection only. A picture of things inevitably fundamentally distorted by the very fact that it's propounded by a judging eye over here, making a claim about a world out there set over against itself. The sweeping only in projection only insists that there's no knowledge that escapes this trap, though there may be a wisdom that's aware of it and senses the world in another way. So it's a startling claim, one that suggests we can't ever escape delusion in any final way. Laying out its elaborate conceptual categories, even though it says all conceptual categories are distortions, the Lanka calls the world as we ordinarily see it imagined reality, and claims that it's a distortion of something it calls dependent reality. Dependent reality, it turns out, means interdependent, no separate things, but instead interpermeation. Imagined reality, which sees fixed, separate entities, is a distortion of this interdependent reality, a distortion caused largely by language and its operation of designation, which, of course, generates the delusion of a world made of seemingly stabilized entities, each with its own stable name, yanked from the flux. But, hold on, in the Lanka, both these views or models, since they are views or models, are projection only. So it's not like you get the interpermeation and that's the true model, right? The notion I relied on earlier of turning around or turning the mind around also comes from the Lanka. Keeping the explanation as simple as I can and hoping not to get too much wrong by doing so, the Lanka propounds a model in which there are eight consciousnesses that are in one way or another specific to individual people. Five for the five senses, a sixth, which I think is language specific, that builds conceptual structures and posits separate things from those sense data, and a seventh, which mistakenly attributes those conceptual structures to a stable self that would be their source. when in fact the concepts generate the sense of self. Then there's the eighth, which is crucial, tricky, and mysterious. It's called the storehouse consciousness, or Alaya Vijnana, and as Joan Sutherland used to explain it, it's a repository for each one of us of all our experiences, or perhaps more accurately, of not only our conscious experiences, but also our unconscious impulses and our raw sense data. It's a little bit like Freud's notion of the preconscious, residues of all those sense data that bombard us all day and never make it into consciousness. But it's also more inclusive. It's also full of precipitates of our feelings and reactions and desires and aversions and distortions. And as such, it's the source, if those traces are repeated and strong enough, of future desire, distortion, impulse, action, and karma. Importantly, it's a multiple, unfocused, mobile, non-narrative collection. If you've seen them, think mirrors all over canvases. These little winking amoebas with no focus, right? These traces don't tell a story with the self at the center, though they can gradually form into patterns which can lead to action, which a self can then claim and construe. But the Lanka says we can turn this around, turn it back on itself. Instead of the common process in which those traces tend to aggregate themselves into impulses, views, judgments, stories, actions, and more karma, we can see through them. Not see the world through them, but see them themselves, and then, as we said before, experience them as rising and falling, as empty. And the more we do this in meditation and elsewhere, the more something else, which isn't a thing, becomes palpable. What is this? Norman Fisher talks about a similar process in which awareness starts becoming aware of awareness. Then he says, if that's too abstract to practice with, you can sit with a sense of presence or an awareness of silence. One interesting thing about this, I think, is that your sense of presence will be neither the same as nor separate from your awareness of particular presences, just as your sense of silence might be neither the same as nor separate from your sense of noise or sound. Particular presences and particular sounds rising and falling in a very big field or as the field. In our tradition, when we work with no, I think it's a similar practice. A student asked Zhaozhou, does a dog have Buddha nature? Zhaozhou replied, no. What is this no? Quick sidebar for students of Joan. She used to invite us, if a compelling problem or obsession grabbed hold of us and didn't seem to want to set us free during retreat, to bring it into our meditation and lean into it, experiencing it as part of the big field of meditative awareness, in defiance of traditional instructions to steer clear of all that stuff. I'm thinking now that was her particular way of inviting us into the practice the Lanka recommends, a gradual shaking loose of the contents of the storehouse consciousness, slowly transforming its memory traces into a local and intimate version of things rising and falling in a spacious, quiet field, a transformation of Alaya Vijnana into what the Lanka calls the Tathagata Garbha, the womb of the Buddhas. So maybe that's a practice we can take up, letting things loosen gradually, a kind of supplement to those rare dramatic moments when some cherished view or opinion suddenly goes poof and everything falls open dramatically. Here's an odd thing, maybe. When we come out of meditation and lift our eyes to the world, it often seems to have some of the same qualities as meditative awareness. So you've been looking at your mind and now you're looking at the world and they seem the same, right? Okay. That's probably at least in part projection, though to the extent we're claimed by something ineffable, maybe not entirely. But if, say, a mostly empty sky with clouds floating through it feels eerily similar to a consciousness in which thoughts appear and dissipate, a version of what Suzuki calls big mind, the translator David Hinton wonders if that's maybe because our very conceptions of our minds, as well as how we think and feel about them, took shape as a kind of metaphorical extrapolation of our awareness of the sky. It's not so much that the sky is like our minds, but more that our sense of what our minds are derives from our experience of the sky. So if Suzuki's big mind sometimes strikes us as a kind of metaphor, at least if we're feeling skeptical, the universe doesn't really have a mind, does it? It might also go the other way around. Our sense of a mind isn't exactly or only our sense of a mind, but a metaphor concocted long ago, Hinton suggests, from our collective experience before anyone remembers of contemplating the sky. That's maybe another way in which we tumble into the world. It turns out the Lanka's rigorous deconstructions have a similarly expansive and liberating purpose. If the Lanka suggests that all our models, all our judgments and opinions about reality are projection only, that isn't to keep the world at bay. It's to slide us out of our inveterate stance as knowers so that we can sense instead or as well the ways in which the world claims us, ready or not, knowing or not. Since there is nothing to attain, the bodhisattva lives by prajnaparamita with no hindrance in the mind, no hindrance, and therefore no fear, far beyond delusive thinking. Except, as we discussed a couple of years ago in our Tucson Heart Sutra study group, far beyond delusive thinking turns out also to mean right in the midst of it. The Lanka insists on this point. If we turn the mind around and see through our projections, what happens next? Well, as we wander around the world then, more projections. Spewing categories, the Lanka supplements imagined reality and dependent reality with perfected reality. Sounds pretty good, right? Finally got it. Okay. But hold on, perfected reality turns out to be not the absence of projections, but just experiencing our projections as projections. As Wallace Stevens said, the necessity to believe in a fiction that we know to be a fiction. So for me, that's something like the kind of wider space that Megan was talking about is available through meditation practice. So perfected reality turns out not to be the absence of projections, but just experiencing our projections as projections. You might say, pardon the expression, it's when we don't project our projections. Or the Lanka says the wise are neither confused nor not confused by delusions. Not confused because they see through them, see them for what they are, but also confused because they continue to see through them, seeing the world in the ways the delusions project. So where do we find ourselves? Maybe we can think of it as those two different senses of seeing through delusions, keeping company with and talking to each other, sometimes amicably even. Since it's American Zen, why not give Bogey the last word? Louis, I think this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship. Okay, thank you. So I'd welcome any questions or conversations. For, I don't know if we do a walk before this. Do we take a walk now or not?
Typically just go right into conversation.
Okay, yeah. I mean, I know that was pretty dense, and I'm sorry, I guess, for how dense it was. I guess I'm mostly interested in the way in which there are these moments where we're kind of claimed by the world and we have a different sense of kind of being in the midst of it, and that gives us a transformed relation maybe to all the projections and delusions and traces that we're held by, and provides a kind of spaciousness around them in the way Megan was talking about. I was thinking also, I've been thinking a lot about the Musa Soseki poem, and the image I got while sitting, you know, before the talk right now was like I was in a boat sort of flowing down the stream of the creek, you know, and there wasn't much steering I could do. So while I was flowing down there, I could sort of see whatever I saw going by and make my own models of it. But the main thing was, you know, that I also had this sense of just being carried along. And that is a kind of different order of where I was and how I was.
I'll say something.